This is Beyond a Reasonable Doubt with your hosts, Mark Garagus and Gary Smith.
Well, welcome to the Sunday edition of Beyond a Reasonable Doubt, where we do a little quick spin around the legal world. And Gary's got, I think, a couple of things teed up today, don't you?
I do. I'm going to start with one that will carry over into our next episode with Adam Carolla this coming Tuesday. I'd just like to go ahead and tease it now. I'm sure it'll be a larger conversation then, a case we've been following pretty much since the inception of Reasonable Doubt. Congratulations, Mark, on finally bringing home the Daniel Shaver case.
Yeah, it's been a long road, and finally there's the girls will be taken care of, and it's quite a resolution. We'll talk about it more on Tuesday, but it's been 6 years. And
well, congratulations. For those who have been listening the whole time, they'll remember Daniel Shaver was the unfortunate case out of Mesa, Arizona, where the police were shouting at this gentleman, and unfortunately it came to a tragic end. But after 6 long years, Mark finally secured a settlement for the family, and it's great that the remaining family members will be taken care of. So congratulations on that. I'm sure we'll get into it more with Adam. What would you like to talk about first today, Mr. Garagus?
I don't know. There's so much that we can. I'm going to let you pick today. You're going to be the agenda setter today.
Well, then we're going to go in order of what you sent me, which is going to be the first video that we're going to play today. And I'll just go ahead and fire it up and we can react.
And you don't even have to conspire with them in order for them to be able to work magic to try and get your information. So we had a president that had access to everything, who had, in my estimation, not a really complete understanding of what he was protecting and his engagements, who he works with. You know, the fact that he has foreign businesses, knowing that he would be in situations where he could be bumped by adversaries who would want the information he had. I mean, you just knew that. And all you had to do was apply the need to know that is applied to any officer at any level.
I think one, say, Gary, just pause there for 1 second. This is what just the analysis that's been done so far is, she sets off that he's got access to everything. So we have to start there. He is the, whoever holds the office of President of the United States, they have theoretically access to everything. So let's start there. Then this idea of the foreign businesses, I understand that. I think that's always been a worry, but that does not mean that they get to say you don't have access. And when I say they, the intelligence community. So let's keep going, because this gets, Larry King used to say, curiouser and curiouser.
Yes, and this is Sue Gordon speaking for those who may only be listening.
Didn't have the need to know. And the remarkable thing about this is, if the day came where the nation decided he needed to know, there would be nothing that would keep him from getting proper access to the material that he improperly has been storing.
Well, this is the question I wanted to ask you. I mean, I've talked to a former, someone who knows and worked with you, a former senior U.S. intelligence official, who said that if he were a normal president and he said, I need these things, can you build me a skiff and can you send down a briefer so that I can stay current on these topics? That may very well have been arranged for him. I mean, it feels like where he's maybe in trouble and a risk to national security and maybe at risk of having committed egregious crimes, maybe even including violating the Espionage Act, is that he lied about it.
Okay, so the first thing I would say, there is zero defense. I cannot imagine an offense for the situation in which we find ourselves. There's just none. There is no justification. There's no excuse. No defense. Zero.
Okay. The idea that there's no defense, if I would agree if this was somebody who didn't hold the presidential office. That's the one basic fact that is missing from this analysis. As a former president who had access to everything, and Nicole Wallace kind of hits it on the head. She says, if he had asked to have a skiff that would have been taken care of. But I believe what he's going to say is, I'm in a fortified, secured area that where the Secret Service is, where they're surrounding me, that you can't get into a more secure area. In fact, in some ways, he probably would take the position that it was more secure than a skiff. And the idea that there's no defense or absolutely zero defense, I think, is just ludicrous. I think that's also, for those who wonder what's taken Merrick Garland so long, besides the fact that there was the give and take between the lawyers and the DOJ, I think that that's a fundamental problem that they're wrestling with. And now that they've got a special counsel, that's going to be a fundamental problem that the special counsel is going to wrestle with. Do we indict a president who had complete access to all of these things? And do we do it because we don't like, and he could still have access to all of these things? Remember, these are things that he had in his possession when he held the office of president. Now, they wanted him back, but are you going to do that under the Espionage Act? Are you going to do that under the archival? I mean, it just, to me, it's a lot more complicated than most people are putting on, and explains greatly, I think, the couple of years that it's taken Merrick Garland to get to the point where he now has appointed a special counsel.
Yeah, I agree completely. And, you know, it's fun for people who, you know, on whatever side want to talk about how it was left in the closet by the golf clubs. But, you know, presumably once a president leaves office, they are fairly well protected, and the residences that they frequent are turned into basically strongholds that are secured by the Secret Service. So the idea that it's just, you know, out at some public golf course that anyone could happen by and just pick up and read is I don't know. It seems disingenuous to me.
Oh, I don't disagree. And maybe they've got a lot more that we don't know about, but I would humbly suggest that the reason it's taken so long is precisely because they're wrestling with these kinds of issues.
Yeah, I that makes perfect sense to me. All right. You want to shift to our other topic, or do you have anything else? Okay. Yeah. So one of our favorite topics as of late is SBF, Sam Bankman-Fried, and a video surfaced this week. And I think we'll just go ahead and watch it, and we can react thereafter.
And you don't eat.
Oops.
One major exchange CEO suspected trouble FTX over 6 months ago. CME Group CEO Terry Duffy says he told FTX founder Sam Bankman-Fried to face, quote, to his face, I should say, you're a fraud, you're an absolute fraud. That was back in March during a meeting with him. Duffy recounted this conversation just days ago with Guy and Dan for their podcast On the Tape. Terry Duffy is here now to take us deeper into that encounter. Terry, this is absolutely fascinating, and what we're finding out now is no surprise to you months ago. How long did it take you to figure out that this guy was a fraud?
Well, Melissa, I don't know if I knew he was a fraud right away. I just didn't, you know what his business was. Here he is. He's trading an inefficient arbitrage out of Hong Kong, making all this money, supposedly. And the next thing I know, he's going to buy CME, he's going to buy Goldman Sachs and everybody else. He's making all these different allegations of what he wants to do. So I met him, as you said, when I gave Guy and Dan the podcast the other day. But what is really interesting is how this whole thing came about, which kind of got my interest up about he is a fraud. And I met earlier in the day with the head of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, and I asked, why are you not dismissing this application out of hand? And he said, because under Section 5B of the Commodity Exchange Act, which calls for innovation, he has to look at it. And I said to him, I said, you don't have to, under the Commodity Exchange Act, have to accept anything that's innovation that puts risk management at the back seat of this. And that's exactly what was going on. So right away, my suspicions were up. Why is there so much pressure coming for this application? Then when I met with him, I knew right away, I said, this is a joke. This is absolutely going nowhere. And then you look who he's traveling with. He's traveling with Mark Wiegand, the former chairman of the CFTC. Now, what was Mark doing for him? I have no idea. Was it credibility or just carrying his briefcase or, I should say, his backpack? And then he's got Ryan Miller. Ryan Miller is the former counsel at the CFTC and became general counsel of the CFTC. And this guy sitting at a bar, could barely pick his head up, saying to me, why won't you let us grow? I said, he said he's worth $26 billion. I'm assuming you've been growing pretty good here. So you could see there was so many different red flags. And then when I got to Washington, you're looking at people like Mike Conway, former head of the Ag Committee, who was an FTX lobbyist. And I heard all these different things coming out of members of Congress. Were they putting pressure on the CFTC? I don't know. But I'll tell you what, there's a hearing come December 1st, and I hope someone has the courage to ask, was anybody putting pressure on the CFTC to move forward with an application that could have put everything at risk? And Melissa, let me say one more thing, which I think is really important. I told my team this had nothing to do with crypto. What he wanted to do was he wanted to list all asset classes, mine, the Intercontinental Exchanges, and everybody else's, under his model, which would have been, as I said, a biblical disaster.
Very, I mean, it's a pretty succinct, I think, the synopsis, if you will, of exactly what could have happened, what did happen, and where, and I don't think he's wrong when he says it could have been a biblical disaster if they had gotten their way.
Yeah, I mean, listening to that, you know, that was, you know, a little over 2 minutes, and he just, you know, no punches pulled, and he, I guess, could make you feel a little bit better about what didn't happen.
Well, I think to some degree, because he, you know, he's not the only person, as you and I have discussed, Elon Musk, in a completely different context, had came away and said something to the effect of his BS meter went off. And
right.
This guy, who has some pretty good credentials, had analyzed this in a fairly succinct way and came away with what a disaster this was headed towards, and has been. And I think it's, as every day that goes by, it unravels even more. And I think you're going to see some action out of this. I know that a lot of people think, no, there's not going to be any consequences to it, but I think there clearly are going to be consequences.
I mean, it's captured the media's attention in such a way that you would think that just for the political points, there's going to have to be some sort of a resolution here. I mean, some shoe is going to have to drop. I mean, the thing has already gotten, and I believe Apple and Amazon have both signed up top tier filmmakers to turn this into a story for their streaming services. So, you know, it's certainly captured the zeitgeist.
Yeah, it certainly has. And we'll talk about it more on Tuesday as well.
All right, Mark, once again, congratulations on the Daniel Shaver situation. We will talk more about it with Mark or with Adam on Tuesday, and I look forward to seeing you then.
Thank you. See you later, Gary.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to Beyond a Reasonable Doubt. Stay tuned for more bonus episodes coming soon.